Hi, and welcome back to our series on Menachem Begin, the sixth Prime Minister of Israel, and our look into what made him Israel's particularly Jewish Prime Minister, a kind of a glimpse into his Jewish soul, and how that affected and shaped his leadership of the State of Israel from the time that he became Prime Minister until his resignation. In previous segments, as you may recall, but just to review, we covered first his birth in the town of Brisk, which we'll actually come back to today a little bit, and his arrival in Palestine in the spring of 1942. Then we looked at his activities in the underground and as the head of the Etzel between 42 and the creation of the State of Israel. We looked at two incidences right around the creation of the state, the terrible tragedy at Deir Yassin and the sinking of the Altalena. Then we looked at his years in the opposition with a whole array of things that showed his deep Jewish sentiments even when he was in the opposition. And last time we looked at the situation with the Vietnamese boat people very briefly, and then of course mostly with the very, very important peace with Egypt, and then briefly at the attack on the Iraqi nuclear reactor in Oss Irak of June of 1981. Today we're going to conclude by looking at the Lebanon War, his resignation as a result of the Lebanon War, and the last years of his life, which he chooses to live in seclusion. To some people, inexplicably. I'm going to argue that it's not so inexplicable. We can pretty much understand, I think, why he did. And again, throughout, just to remind you, we're going to look not at the details of the war or the details of the politics, but try to understand how his Jewish soul animated what it was that he did. Now, just to bring us up to date, when we last left our story, we were in 1981 with Oss Irak. And we have to remember now that Menachem Begin has completely transformed his reputation internationally. This is a man who was known originally in the early days of the state as quote unquote the butcher of Deir Yassin. He was actually called that by some people. He was known as the person who had blown up the King David Hotel. He was seen by the ruling party of Israel, Mapai, Mapam, the Haganah previously, as being the unruly leader of the Etzel. And he is now a person who has basically captured the attention and the heart of the world. He has made Israel's first treaty with an Arab country. We're having this conversation in the middle of August of 2020, where Israel's now entered into a relationship with the UAE. We take it for granted that there can be other countries that will eventually make peace with Israel. There was nothing to be assumed about that in 1977 when he did what he did. He had gotten the Nobel Peace Prize, and he had proven himself victorious in the Oss Irak attack. It was, again, a kind of a surprise for some people that the man who had gotten the Peace Prize would then attack a foreign country, but everybody understood that they were unrelated, that he was going to do what needed to be done to keep Israel safe. We're going to see today that the last years of his life, the last years of his premiership, and the last years of his life in general were painful and not filled with the same kind of successes that he had had. And Anita Shapira has pointed out, Anita Shapira is one of Israel's leading historians, and she has pointed out on a number of occasions that a number of Israeli prime ministers stayed a little bit too long. And if they had only resigned earlier than they did, they would have been seen in an entirely different light. David Ben-Gurion, of course, was prime minister, then resigned, then came back as prime minister. And by the time he finally left the premiership, the country was really very ready for him to go. And Anita Shapira suggests that had he left just a few months or even a few years earlier, his reputation in Israel would have been very different. The same thing is true of Menachem Begin. Had he retired in the summer of 1981, or had he not run for a re-election, he would have a very, very different reputation than he does today. He still has, and I'll come back to this towards the end, a stellar reputation in Israel, even among the left, which might surprise you. But nonetheless, the last part of his life that we're going to cover today is not the most joyous part of his life at all. And to get into it, and to begin to understand the origins of the Lebanon War, we have to go back to the 1960s. We have to go back to 1964 with the creation of the PLO. Very important to remember that the PLO, which is created with the express purpose of destroying Israel, of liberating Palestine from the river to the sea, in 64, this is before there's an occupation. This is before the Six-Day War. So the idea that the Palestinian drive to destroy Israel is a result of the 67 occupation is clearly just not true, because Arafat's Fatah joins in with the PLO in the mid-60s. Arafat himself doesn't actually found the PLO, but his Fatah quickly takes it over, and Arafat becomes the major thorn in Israel's side for a very long time. He begins to base his activities primarily out of Jordan after a while, which is an enormous problem for King Hussein, who does not want to get involved in an imbroglio with Israel over their presence there. And don't forget, King Hussein is a Hashemite king ruling a Palestinian majority. So he also doesn't need more Palestinians in his country. He doesn't need armed Palestinians in his country. And in September of 1970, he launches what's called by most of the Palestinians to this day, Black September, in which he exiles Arafat out of Jordan. Arafat will eventually take up residence in South Lebanon, which we'll come back to in a minute. And Hussein kills thousands of PLO fighters, thousands of them. The world doesn't quite remember this very much, but that was done by King Hussein of Jordan. Arafat moves to Lebanon, A, because it still has a border with Israel, obviously, so it's a good location for him. Lebanon is also embroiled in a deep civil war between the Maronite Christians and the Muslim population. There were actually Shiites, Sunnis, and Druze all on the other side from the Maronite Christians. Lebanon, therefore, is a very unruly, unruled kind of place, and it's a perfect place for Arafat to insinuate himself and his men. Again, the following incidents have nothing to do with Begin at all, but I'll just put them in to give us a sense of a reminder of what's happening in these years in the 1970s. 1972 is the attack on the Munich Olympics. Of course, we all of us remember, those of us who were alive and those of us who saw it after, the very famous black and white pictures of the masked figures on the porches and so forth. And then in June, July of 1976, is the hijacking of Air France 139 and the Entebbe operation. So Arafat is the one who is unleashing international terror. We take international terror as a matter, unfortunately, of human life these days, but it is in many respects the invention of the Palestinians and the invention in particular of Yasser Arafat. Now, when he's not disrupting or creating mayhem and murder at the Munich Olympic Games or hijacking jets, the PLO is relentlessly firing rocket fire into northern Israel. You can think of it a little bit like Sderot today from Gaza, the same kind of thing. When the rocket fire comes, it can be devastating, it's relentless. Don't forget, back then there's no Iron Dome. And cities in the north like Kiryat Shmona are just living constantly in dread. Children sleep night after night in bomb shelters and so on and so forth. And Begin realizes that he has really one of two choices by the time this is happening at the end of the 1970s, 77, 78. He can really do one of two things. He can either launch some sort of military action in Lebanon to push the PLO further north into Lebanon and away from Israel's border, or he can order the building of gigantic bomb shelters in the north, in which people will essentially live encased in steel and concrete structures. Now you have to factor in Hadar. You have to remember the anthem of Beitar. You have to remember Jabotinsky's worldview that this Zionist movement was about Jewish pride. It was about Jewish safety, but it was also about Jewish pride. And what Begin says to himself, it's very clear, is we did not create this country for Israeli children to cry themselves to sleep at night in bomb shelters with the thuds of rockets hitting outside. That is just not what this country was about. And therefore, it's clear that in his own mind, he is gelling this idea that something has to be done militarily. In March of 1978 comes the very famous Coastal Road Massacre, where PLO terrorists have sailed south in little boats from Lebanon, come onto the shore not too far from Tel Aviv. They hijacked an intercity bus. And in the shootout with Israeli troops who got to the bus, they killed 38 Israelis and injured 71, what Time magazine called the worst terrorist attack in Israel's history. That happened on the 11th of March. By the 15th of March, Begin sends troops into Lebanon. This is not the Lebanon War yet. He sends the troops in to push them back beyond the Litani River, which is slightly above the northern border, but not nearly as far as Israel will ultimately go. And it works, except that Israel then pulls back, because Begin has no intention of staying in Lebanon. And as soon as he pulls back, the PLO comes right back south. So they had gotten nothing from the Litani operation. But he made it very clear to the Knesset what this was about. And he thunders to them when there was objection to Israel invading a foreign country, Israel initiating a military operation as opposed to all the other wars, which were defensive wars. He thunders to the Knesset, "Gone forever are the days when Jewish blood will be shed with impunity. We shall sever the arm of iniquity." This is the same Menachem Begin as if he was speaking to the British in the 1940s. And what we're going to see in a little while is that the same Menachem Begin who was in the 1970s and the early 80s, the man who had also led the revolt against the British, has in a certain way not understood completely how much the world has changed from the 40s to the 70s and the 80s, but we'll come back to that in a little while. We also have to understand that meanwhile, back at the ranch, so to speak, Ronald Reagan, who was the president of the United States, is losing patience with Menachem Begin. He was very angry at the attack on Oz Yirok, and he is very, very upset with this idea that Israel's going to go into Lebanon. He sees that that Syria's army is just pouncing, ready to pounce for some sort of involvement. He does not want Syrian troops moving their way westward into Lebanon. And so it makes it very clear to Begin, you better not do anything that's going to precipitate Syrian involvement in Lebanon. And Begin says to Reagan as follows, my generation, dear Ron, swore on the altar of God that whoever proclaims his intent to destroy the Jewish state or the Jewish people or both seals his fate so that what happened from Berlin will never happen again. The world has not changed as far as Begin is concerned. This is the same vicious attack on the Jewish people, an existential threat as far as he's concerned. American Jews are getting very unhappy with Israel's elbowing its way into Lebanon, even though the war had not really started in any meaningful way yet. And he says in an NBC interview in April 1982, to these American Jews who are very unhappy, he says, if they attack us again, we shall hit them again, because we will not allow in our generation of the Holocaust and redemption, Israel is redemption for the Holocaust, Jewish blood to be shed again, while those responsible for its shedding enjoy impunity and even luxury. It happened in the Holocaust. It will never happen again. He is even facing resistance from inside Israel. Yosef Burg, one of the giants of Israeli politics back then and the founder of the NRP, the National Religious Party, says to Begin he's not sure that this whole elbowing in Lebanon is a very good idea. And Begin unleashes at him in the Knesset. And he says in Hebrew, obviously, but here's a translation, we will be nobody's cowering Jew. We won't wait for the Americans or the United Nations to save us. Don't forget 67 and 73, where the United States had basically done nothing to save Israel. Those days are over. We will have to defend ourselves. Without readiness for self-sacrifice, there will be another Auschwitz. Without readiness for self-sacrifice, think Beitar Anthem. Literally lifted right out of the Beitar Anthem. And if we have to pay a price for the sake of our self-defense, then we will pay it. Yes, war means bloodshed, bereavement, and orphans, and that is a terrible thing to contemplate. But when an imperative arises to protect our people from being bled, as they are now being bled in the Galilee, how can any of us have any doubt what it is that we have to do? So it is clear that Begin has his finger on the trigger. The PLO is not going to relent. The Americans are opposed. The region is getting very, very tense. And in order to understand what's next, and particularly in order to understand how the Lebanon War is going to have the impact on Menachem Begin that it does, we need to go back to the history of the figure of Ariel Sharon, whom we've not discussed very much, because until this particular moment, Sharon, who had been Scheinerman in Europe, and the Begins do not intersect all that very much. Now, you may recall that the Scheinermans and the Begins did intersect in Brisk. In 1904, right after Theodore Herzl dies, Begin's father and Ariel Sharon's grandfather want to hold a memorial service for Herzl in the Soloveitchik Shul. The Soloveitchik family at that point was not predisposed towards Zionism. Of course, things have changed dramatically since then. And you may recall the story that the rabbi said no. Rabbi Soloveitchik said, no, you can't use the shul. So Scheinerman and Begin's father, that is, broke down the door of the shul, had their memorial service, and then left the shul. And I believe that I mentioned in our very first episode, quite ironically, that Ariel Sharon's grandmother had been the midwife at Menachem Begin's birth, which is just a curiosity of sorts. It has no significance later on. But nonetheless, Ariel Sharon grows up on a farm. He grows up not religious at all, with very little Jewish education, but a deep love of the land of Israel, the people of Israel, the language of the people of Israel. He's a lover of Hebrew. And he is a brilliant field commander. He is wounded in the 1948 war because of what he saw as ridiculous decisions on the part of his commanders who were way back from the front. And he swore that he would never again trust people who were not at the front lines, and that if he himself ever became a commander, he would be at the front lines. And that was an oath that he lived up to for the rest of his life. In the 1950s, he founds Unit 101, which we won't get into, but a very complicated unit, which is meant to conduct, among other things, reprisals against people coming in from Jordan. There's a terrible incident in Qibya in 1953, in which 69, mostly civilians, are killed by Unit 101. Now, in that particular instance, by the way, Sharon had had those orders. That was not Sharon's decision. Most people agree that Sharon was ordered to conduct that raid, but conduct that raid he did. Very often getting reports from Sharon about what was really happening in the field was not the easiest thing to do. David Ben-Gurion would write in his diary not that long later, and here I'm quoting, "Were he to be weaned of his fault of not speaking the truth in his reports, he would make an exemplary military leader." But as we'll see, he would not be weaned of that fault. In 1956, in the famous Sinai campaign, Sharon disobeys orders and without authorization captures the Mitla Pass. It proved to be an extraordinarily brilliant thing to do militarily, but it angered the higher brass because it had no authorization to do that, and Israel did suffer some significant casualties in that. And in 1973, he literally took the risk of his life by having Israeli tanks that were unprotected and unprepared cross the Suez Canal completely without authorization. Looking back, everyone agrees that that saved the 73 war. That if Israel won the 73 war militarily, it was because of what Ariel Sharon did in crossing the Suez Canal back onto the Egyptian side and encircling the Third Army there. But he had done all of this with tremendous risk without any authorization from the top. And from then on, really, the top brass politically and militarily were very, very worried of him. He was a genius, a military genius, and personally very, very courageous, but fundamentally uncontrollable, and fundamentally, they thought at least, a liar, and we're going to see why that comes back to play a huge role in Begin's life. On June 3rd, 1982, which is just a couple of days shy of a year after the successful attack on the Iraqi nuclear reactor at Oz Irak, Shlomo Argov, who is Israel's ambassador to England, is shot in the head by Palestinian terrorists in London. There were four or five, depending on whose account one buys. Argov did not die. He remained in a coma for 3 months, after which he regained consciousness. Then he was brought back to Israel. He remained in the hospital. He eventually became blind from the injury, and he was hospitalized for 21 years until he died. So the Argov story in and itself is a horrible tragedy, and it's much more complicated. He was an extraordinary human being, but we don't have time right now to go into that. But that attack on Argov in June of 1982 is really all that Begin either needs or wants, it's not clear, in order to send troops into Lebanon, because as far as he's concerned, the situation has to stop. Now, Israel goes in, and the very famous argument is that Israel was going to go only 40 kilometers into Lebanon. Reagan says that that's what Begin promised him. Begin says that's what Sharon promised the cabinet. Sharon insists he never made any such promise, and it would have been ludicrous to do that, because why would you push them 40 kilometers in and then leave them? So there is a huge disagreement in Israeli history, but most of the consensus is that the cabinet, Begin, and Reagan all had an understanding somehow that Sharon was authorized to go 40 kilometers into Lebanon, but not further than that. Now, this plan of getting the PLO pushed north, and 40 kilometers would have kept them way out of rocket range at that point from Israel, this whole plan depended on one major element over which Israel had exactly zero control. And that was the idea that Bashar Gemayel, who was the head of the Maronite Christians, who had just become the head of Lebanon, stay in power. As long as the Christians in Lebanon were in power, and don't forget we've said that Lebanon was in a civil war, so the power shifted back and forth all the time. But as long as the Christians stayed in power in Lebanon, then Begin and Sharon, the Israelis, could be reasonably sure that if they could push the PLO northward, the Christians would keep the cover on the PLO and somehow not let them spread. But of course, that was something that Israel had no control over, whether or not Bashar Gemayel would stay in power, and he didn't because he was killed by Muslim operatives. They were really Syrian operatives. Don't forget Reagan's worry about the Syrians getting involved. It was quite prescient, actually. And at that point, Israel's whole plan falls apart, because with the Muslims in charge of Lebanon, even if Israel can push the PLO north, there's going to be nobody to control the PLO at all or to stop them from coming back south. Meanwhile, there are two refugee camps, which are now very famous, called Sabra and Shatila, which have become extremely crowded. Many of the people in these camps are PLO fighters who were there in these camps to avoid being deported with Arafat, who was first sent out to Greece originally and then off to Tunis, more or less, which would be his base of operations. Eventually, of course, he'll come back to the Middle East after the Oslo Accords, but that's a separate story altogether. And Sharon tells Begin about that the IDF is going to take control of the area around Sabra. He does not mention Shatila at all. He tells Begin, we're going to take control of the area around the Sabra refugee camp because it's filled with PLO fighters. Now, again, there's a whole debate, which I alluded to last time also, about how much Begin is really in control of the details these days, how much he really understands, how much his physical weariness and his physical ailments are taking away from his ability to get into the details. But nonetheless, on the second night of Rosh Hashanah in September 1982, Begin turns on the radio. And just as had happened with the King David, he tunes to the BBC. And it's from the BBC, of all sources, that Begin finds out what had happened in the Sabra and Shatila camps. He finds out, as many of us know, of course, already, that the Christian phalangists, who were known to be no less murderous than the Palestinians themselves, had entered the camps. No Israelis had entered the camps. No Israelis had fired a shot. But the Israelis had let them into the camp, and there are actually videos of this. The Israelis had brightened up the sky with their own flares to enable the Christian phalangists to see what was going on in the dark in these camps. The Christian phalangists stay in the camps for several days, and by the time international press can get in, what they find is hundreds. Some people estimate between 700 and 800 Muslim men, women, and children, many of them with their hands tied behind their backs, lying slaughtered, dead in the streets. Now, this was an unbelievably horrifying massacre, no matter what one's political view is, to line these men, women, and children up, regardless of what you may think about the PLO or anything else. And there is really no denying that the Israeli soldiers lit up the sky. There is no denying that the Israeli soldiers let them in. What Sharon said was, we lit up the sky because they asked us to. We let them in because they asked us to. We had no idea what was going to happen inside. Most people did not buy that. The shooting went on for 3 days. It's a little hard to imagine that nobody outside heard anything, but this, of course, will become the subject of the Kahan Commission. When Begin understands this, what happens, he also hears, of course, that the world is immediately blaming Israel. And he says to Yehuda Avner, when he sees him the next day on Rosh Hashanah, he says in Yiddish, which was, of course, the language that both Begin and Ben-Gurion resorted to when they got upset. When we get upset, we go back to our mother tongues. And the great irony is that Ben-Gurion, who changed his name, who wore those Israeli Sabra outfits, who stood on his head on the sand to prove just how non-European he was, when he got upset, he also reverted to Yiddish. But Begin says to Avner, "Hast du gehört eise meise? Have you heard of such a thing in your life?" And he basically says, "Goyim kill Goyim, and the world blames the Jews." That was his very famous line, which he repeated to a number of people. And here one has to say, and I say this with tremendous sadness, Begin showed that to a very great extent he was trapped in the past. Because the idea of the world blaming everything on the Jews and Goyim killing Goyim, it was a very European metaphor. And this idea of the blameless Jew, which of course Begin had grown up with because of the Shoah, that's not the situation anymore, right? It's the Israelis who are the ones in power here. It's the Palestinians, the women and the children, but even some of the men who are the victims. And Begin was very slow to respond to it. Had he come out with a statement right away saying that Israel abhors this action, Israel's going to investigate this action, he takes no responsibility for having ordered it, but he will take full responsibility for investigating it, he might have been able to get things to go in a different direction, but that is not the response that he took. There is a tremendous amount of outrage about Begin, about Sharon, and once again the signs go up. Begin the murderer, Begin Dir Yassin, Sharon the, Begin, the murderer of children, and so on and so forth. There is huge public outcries, thousands and thousands of people protesting in the streets and without any alternative whatsoever. Begin appoints the Kahan Commission. Now we're going to come back to what the Kahan Commission will say in its conclusion, but we have to now take another aside to go into something else that's happening in Begin's life. In November of 1982, Eliza, his wife of all these years, is hospitalized at Hadassah Ein Karem, and she is intubated. She had had asthma for a very long time. You may recall that she had actually been sick with respiratory illnesses when they first fled Warsaw for Russia. So she's dealt with this her whole life. But at this point, she is older, obviously. She is ailing. She's in Hadassah. She's intubated, so she can't speak. But he and she are communicating with notes, and she's completely alert and lucid. And he tells her that he's not going to make his planned trip to Los Angeles to speak to the Federations, that he's going to stay with her. And she writes him a note and says, no, you should go. So he actually does go. He goes with a whole array of people, including his cardiologist, without whom he never traveled at that point. And as many people know, of course, in the middle of Shabbat, Benny calls the entourage in Los Angeles on the phone to tell them that Eliza has died. They can't even tell Begin at that point because his doctor had gone to shul. For those of you that know Los Angeles a little bit, the hotel was on Century Boulevard, and he'd gone to shul in the Pico Robertson area, which is a bit of a hike. I mean, not impossible, but it was a bit of a hike. So by the time the doctor got back, a tremendous amount of time, a couple of hours had gone by. But then in the presence of the doctor, they tell Begin that Eliza has died. He is distraught. The entire group packs up. They head to the airport. They get back on his plane. They fly back to Israel. And according to people who were on the plane with him, there was a room on the side that he had for himself. And he stayed in the room the entire time. And they could hear him crying from inside the room. Lama azavti ota, lama azavti ota. Why did I leave her? Why did I leave her? And we need to understand the profundity of this loss for Begin in order to understand what happens next in his life. He had been through thick and thin. He had been basically through more than most people would experience in 10 lifetimes. The imprisonment, the underground, being hunted by the British, all the operations that went well, all the operations that did not go well, losing 8 elections in a row, winning the 9th, and so on and so forth. And there'd been one person by his side the entire time, and that was Eliza. And she was the one, as he said himself when he got elected, remember, Zacharti lach chesed nuraich, ahavat klulotayich, lechtech acharai, be'eretz zruat mokshim. He paraphrased the prophet and said, I remember the love of your youth when you followed me not into the desert, but you followed me into a land filled with mines. The woman who had followed him lovingly, wholeheartedly into a land filled with mines was no longer, and in the most existential sense possible, Menachem Begin was completely alone in the world. Of course he had children, of course he had friends, but he was alone. Shortly after he buries her on Har HaZeitim, on the Mount of Olives, which we'll come back to a little while later, the Kahan Commission calls on him actually to testify. And when he testifies, he sits at a plain table. There's photographs of this, and he's asked for his name. It's a little bit absurd, obviously, asking the prime minister of the state for his name, but of course it's for the record. It's completely legitimate. And what does he say? He says his name is Menachem Ben Ze'ev Dov V'Chasya Begin. In other words, he puts the traditional Jewish piece out there for a moment to say, that's really who I am. I am Menachem Ben Ze'ev Dov V'Chasya. The family name is Begin. He doesn't say anything about being prime minister. He doesn't say anything about anything else. This is the same name that he would have given about himself if he'd been called before a Beit Din in the town of Brisk. As far as Begin's concerned, nothing has changed. That's the Jew that he is. Now, there is, of course, a huge amount of debate to this very day about to what extent Ariel Sharon deceived Begin, to what extent he told him the truth, but Begin couldn't understand. And just to give you a sense of how deeply held or how deeply convicted people were of their views on this, just an experience that I had when I was working on the Begin book. On one instance, coincidentally, I went the very same day to see Yechiel Kadishai in Tel Aviv and Aryeh Naor, who was one of Begin's close associates in Jerusalem in his house in Rehavia. And I went to Kadishai first that day. I drove up to Tel Aviv, met with Kadishai for a few hours. He was, I think I may have mentioned this, appalled that there was some Jabotinsky poem that I didn't know by heart. And so he said to me, get up, get that book over there. We took the book off. He turns to a certain page and he said, read it out loud. So at least, you know, at the end of the interview, I've learned a little bit of Jabotinsky poetry. But that particular day, I asked Kadishai, to what extent did Sharon manipulate Begin? Did Sharon lie to Begin? Was Begin confused? And Kadishai, who was insistent on defending Begin's lucidity to the very end, said, absolutely not. Begin understood exactly what was going on. Begin knew where the tanks were. Begin knew where the soldiers were. Begin knew where the PLO were. Whatever choices Sharon made, Begin knew about it. Now that, of course, implicates Begin in certain ways, but it was important to Kadishai to make it clear that Begin was in no way absent in some intellectual or cognitive sense. Then I get in the car, I drive back to Jerusalem, I meet Aryeh Naor. I'll never forget, he was actually delayed a little bit because he was loading a new app on his iPad for the Daf Yomi. And I remember thinking to myself as I was waiting in his living room for the thing to load up, this is an amazing Israel. You know, you go to Kadishai in Tel Aviv and he makes you read Jabotinsky. You go down to Jerusalem to Naor and he makes you wait while he's loading up a Daf Yomi app. It's a pretty extraordinary place, this country, and that day brought it home for me. And I asked Naor, do you think that Sharon lied to Begin? And he says, what are you talking about? Of course Sharon lied to Begin. Sharon lied to everybody, and Sharon lied to Begin about this. Now, obviously, Naor has and had a great deal of respect for many things about Sharon himself, but he was very clear that he thought that Sharon had manipulated Begin by revealing certain things, by making some things obfuscated, unclear, and that Begin had been completely manipulated. Why does that matter? It matters because we have to remember that for Menachem Begin, Ariel Sharon was a figure out of the Tanakh. Ariel Sharon could have been Yoav ben Tsruya, King David's commander in chief. In other words, this was a biblical tapestry. What was unfolding in the land of Israel was Melachim Gimel, right? The third book of Kings, so to speak. And Begin didn't see himself as a king in any way whatsoever, but he saw the narrative and the drama and the story, which, by the way, is one of the grandest stories in the history of humankind. He saw it as a direct continuation of what the Tanakh had spoken about. And therefore, if it is true that Menachem Begin felt that Ariel Sharon, this biblical figure, had lied to him, if it is true, and we will never know for sure, then it is very clear that something in Begin shattered. Something in Begin was broken because the biblical figure, so to speak, of Ariel Sharon had actually misled him. So now we have to understand how in his own personal life, everything is literally falling completely apart. He is the man who had won the Nobel Peace Prize, and now protesters outside his window were holding up signs with the numbers of Israeli casualties in Lebanon, and that number was getting very, very high. Israel would, of course, be in Lebanon for 18 years until Ehud Barak got the troops out in the year 2000. The killer of Deir Yassin, as they called him, had redeemed his name, had saved his name, had reinvented his reputation, but was now once again being called the killer of Sabra and Shatila. The victor in Osirak in Iraq was now the loser in Lebanon. He was failing physically. He had a lot of maladies, among them heart maladies, but other things as well. And Aliza was dead. It would be hard to imagine a life coming more apart at the seams, and his was, and that was how he felt. On his 70th birthday, on August 19th, 1983, some people, like Kadishai, thought that he might actually resign, but he didn't. He didn't want to confuse the public nature of the birthday party with a resignation, because he wanted that to be very private, but less than 10 days later, 9 days later, on August 28th, Kadishai walks into his office and Begin says, I'm glad you're here, I'm resigning. Kadishai was not surprised, but many others were. And people came to him all day long and pleaded with him not to make it public, not to go ahead with it. They would support him more, they would help him more, they would have his back. And his response to all of them was exactly the same, Ani lo yachol yoter. I just can't do it anymore. I think those were the truest words anyone ever spoke. And it reminds us, of course, for those of us who know the history of some of the great leaders that he followed, of Zev Jabotinsky's very last words, I am so tired. and then he got down on a bed in that camp on Long Island and died of a heart attack. And Thur Herzl had said to Reverend William Heckler, who had come to greet him when he was already on his deathbed in 1904, they had been intended to go to Palestine together, and Herzl understood that that trip was not going to happen. So he says to Heckler, "Greet Palestine for me. I gave my heart's blood for my people." And a day later, he was dead. So there was really a whole long tradition, a heartbreaking tradition, of these Zionist leaders who literally worked themselves to their very deaths. And Menachem Begin was not in any way dead, but he was emotionally spent. He was done. He couldn't do it anymore. And the resignation, of course, does come to be. Yitzhak Shamir will become Israel's seventh prime minister. Shamir, who had been the Lehi head, while Begin had been the head of the Eitzel, and so forth. Leah, his youngest daughter, had never gotten married, and she had moved into the prime minister's residence at a certain point. Now she and he have to move out. It's very important to know, Begin had won the Nobel Peace Prize. A lot of money comes with a Nobel Peace Prize. Begin literally had nowhere to go. He had given all the money for the prize away. It actually still generates prizes to this day for young people doing all sorts of things. He did not have a penny to his name. They had rented their apartment when they had been in the opposition for all those years in Tel Aviv. I think I've said to you before that it was a one-bedroom apartment where the three children, one boy and two girls, but really well into their adolescence, all lived in one room. And he and Eliza had an L-shaped sofa that at night they pushed together. This was really a man of very humble origins, who literally had nowhere to go. When he left the prime minister's office, there was nothing. There was no bank account, there was no house, there was no apartment. His friends got together, put some money together, and got him a house on Tzemach Street, not that far from Har Herzl. And he became known as the prisoner of Tzemach Street. He became known as the prisoner of the house because he hardly ever went out. Between the time that he goes into that house, more or less at the end of 1983, until his death in 1992, he comes out for memorial ceremonies for Eliza, hospital visits, and nothing else. There are certain memorial ceremonies for Eliza that he will actually miss. At the beginning, especially, he had a terrible rash on his face, and he was very self-conscious about it, so he refused to even go to the memorial service then, because he knew he'd be photographed. He was not stupid, and he therefore just stayed in the house for very, very long periods of time. He saw Kaddishai regularly. He saw Meridor regularly. A few years later, he actually had a slight improvement in his health condition. He had successful prostate surgery. He widened his social circle a little bit. He saw a few other people, but basically he lived by himself. Just as he'd started his life in Palestine in the 1940s, hiding from the British, he ended his life in the 1980s and early 1990s, hiding from the Israelis. He started his life in Palestine in utter silence, and he ended his life in Israel in utter silence. In the middle, he was Israel's most famous and most able orator. I think I may have mentioned that people talked about the fact that when the rumor circulated around the Knesset that Begin was going to come to the rostrum, the Knesset would empty. Person after person told me this when I was researching the book. The people that worked in the library, the people that worked in the cafeteria, if rumors spread that Begin was about to speak in a meaningful, significant speech kind of a way, everybody went into the plenum to try to hear what it was that he was going to say. So the man who was really Israel's most powerful orator, and it's worth listening to some of those videos that are easily findable online, starts his life in Palestine in utter silence and hiding, and heartbreakingly ends his life in Israel in utter silence. Now, why the seclusion? Everybody debates this, and many people believe that the answer is not clear. Anita Shapira said that she thinks it's the ethic of the old Zionists. You sort of, you know, you bite your lip, you keep your mouth shut. If you're unhappy with people, you just sort of absorb it. Kaddishai said, I think it's not very plausible, that Begin was worried that just like Ben-Gurion had been called back to the premiership, he was afraid that he would be called back to the premiership. When Ben-Gurion didn't want to go back, he didn't go back. I don't think Begin had anything to worry there. Thomas Friedman said, in typical Thomas Friedman style, and at this point, by the way, Friedman had been very supportive of Begin in the early days, that Begin had tried himself and found himself guilty, presumably for Sabra and Shatila. But I think Begin gave us the answer. I'm one of those few people who does not believe that Begin never explained it. I think Begin explained it very clearly. He said, "Ani lo yachol yoter. I can't anymore. And if you were Menachem Begin, there was nothing that was private. If he went to the hospital, people put microphones and cameras in front of him. He went to a memorial service for Aliza. People put microphones and cameras in front of him. There was no way not to be a public figure unless he was literally going to stay away from the public. But the reality is, of course, quite sadly, that he lived a very, very alone life, mostly with Leah and with a few visitors for those last years of his life. In 1990, he fell, and as is true with many people, when they get to an advanced age, a fall can have a huge impact on one's health. And he's still in the hospital, actually went under Shamir, Iraq, the very same Iraq, fires missiles at Israel in the famous war that everybody remembers. He gives one interview on the 50th anniversary of the death of Jabotinsky to Channel One. And among the things that he says was, he was asked what was the hardest decision that he ever made, and he said it was the killing of those two British sergeants. And he remarked about Ben-Gurion that he and Ben-Gurion had been rivals, he called it. That's not exactly the word that you would use to describe what happened on the beach during the Altalena. But he said they had been rivals, but he said they had also become friends. And that was actually true. When I was working on the book, after the book came out, unfortunately, so I wasn't able to put this in, somebody came up and told me that they had been working in the Knesset and they had actually witnessed that Begin was still in the Knesset, Ben-Gurion was no longer in the Knesset, but very much alive and obviously could get into the Knesset whenever he wanted to. Begin, of course, was not prime minister yet, right? Begin doesn't become prime minister till 77, and Ben-Gurion dies in 73. But at the period when Begin was still in the Knesset and Ben-Gurion was out of public life, periodically came back to the Knesset, there was a scene where a few people were seated at a table. Like in kind of high school cafeteria, there's people sitting around the table and somebody comes up and there's no space at the table. And this woman told me that she saw Menachem Begin leapt up, gave Ben-Gurion his chair, went to get another chair for himself, and there was some amiable chatter between the two. So there was a kind of a warming, especially after 67, when Ben-Gurion learned that it was Begin's idea that he come back, but it was a tense relationship. One of the most heart-wrenching, heart-warming images of those last years of his life, someone else told me, it was one of his meetings with Yochanan Bader. Yochanan Bader had been that childhood friend of his who'd also been the one who had told him that he should join the Free Polish Army to get out of prison in Russia, and then was the man who always sat next to him when he was in the opposition in the Knesset, and Ben-Gurion would never call him Mr. Begin. He always referred to him as the man sitting next to M.K. Bader, which was, of course, ridiculous and insulting, but that's what Ben-Gurion did for all those years. But they were finally brought together by Kadishai towards the end of their lives in a park to sit next to each other and talk. Bader was basically completely deaf at this point, and Begin was so weak that he couldn't raise his voice. So Kadishai said that basically he passed notes back and forth between them, and at a certain point they had exhausted what there was to talk about, but they just sat on the bench and looked at each other, enjoying each other's company. You can kind of try to imagine what they thought about and what the panorama of history from their lives in Europe to what they had just now witnessed until the early 1990s, what they had accomplished and what they had witnessed and so forth. In March 1992, Begin suffers a very, very serious heart attack. And a few days later, on March 9th, 1992, he dies in the early hours of the morning. He had left a will, and the envelope with the will was opened up, and here's what it said. There were obviously no assets to distribute. My dear Yechiel, when the day comes, I request you to read this to my dear ones, my friends, and my comrades. Comrades, this request. I ask to be buried on the Mount of Olives next to Meir Feinstein and Moshe Barazani. I thank you and all those who will carry out my request with love, Menachem. That's all he wanted. He wanted to be buried on Har HaZeitim next to Feinstein and Barazani. Feinstein had been an Eitzel fighter who'd been captured by the British and sentenced to death. Barazani had been a Lehi fighter, captured in a different incident altogether, also sentenced to death. And as it's become an iconic story in the history of the early part of the Yeshuv, or the late part of the Yeshuv before the state, Feinstein and Barazani were scheduled to be hanged on the same day, and someone smuggled into them, into the jail, a hand grenade, which they were then going to pull the pin, and kill the hangman in addition to themselves, of course, dying. But the rabbi of the jail came to them the day before and told them, don't worry, I will be with you until the very last moment. So that scuttled that plan because they couldn't do it. So they hugged themselves, they hugged each other in their jail cell. They sang Adon Olam so that the whole prison could hear, pulled the pin, and the two of them, of course, died on the spot. And it was that heroism, it was that sense of purpose. And by the way, Feinstein had left a letter saying that the proudest thing about his life had been serving in the Eitzel, and he would do it all over again. It was those two people that Menachem Begin wanted to be buried next to. He didn't want to be buried on Har Herzl. A number of Israeli premiers chose not to be buried on Har Herzl. David Ben-Gurion chose to be buried in Sde Boker, in the Negev, in the desert, which was the place in Israel that he loved most. Ariel Sharon was buried on his family's farm. So he was not the first or the last person not to be buried on Mount Herzl, but that's where he chose to be buried. He wanted a very simple funeral. He didn't want a formal funeral. He did not want to lie in state in front of the Knesset, as many other people have. He wanted simply to be buried, Kaddish, El Malei Rachamim, and that be it. He died in the early hours of the morning, as I mentioned. The funeral was called in Israeli tradition for the very same day at 4 p.m. in the afternoon. He wanted a private funeral, and 75,000 people showed up. So if you can envision Jerusalem in the place right below the Jaffa Gate, where the street below the Jaffa Gate comes near from the Cinematheque, where they meet at the bottom of that valley, where you'd have to actually start, then wind your way up towards the Mount of Olives. It's backed up all the way to there. It's crazy how far backed up it is. And of course, anywhere near the Mount of Olives, anywhere near there, there's buses that are piled back. Very, very few people can get anywhere close, but it's a national moment. The videos of Menachem Begin's funeral are very, very, very hard to find, but they are out there a little bit. Most of them are still, the rights are protected, so they're only included in other documentaries that got rights and so forth. But one of the most powerful images of that funeral is to see him, of course, in Israeli fashion. There's no casket. It's just a body of an older man wrapped up in a tallit on a stretcher. And the stretcher is carried up the winding gravel path by a group of old men who had been his fighters in the Etzel. In other words, that many decades later, they just carried their commander to his final resting place. And I should mention, of course, that for Begin, the decision to be married on Har HaZeitim is not accidental. It's not just because it's an old cemetery, and it figures back into this notion of his biblical statesmanship. Here is the prophet Zechariah. V'yatza Adonai v'nilcham b'goyim ahem k'yom hilachmo b'yom krav. And then the Lord will come forth and make war on those nations, as he is wont to make war on a day of battle. This is a vision of the end of days. Ve'amdu raglav bayomahu al har hazeitim, asher al pnei Yerushalayim mikedem, v'nivka har hazeitim mechetzio mizracha. And on that day, the Lord will set his feet on the Mount of Olives near Jerusalem on the east. And then a few verses later, one that we all know, v'haya Adonai lemelech al kol haaretz, bayomahu yieh Adonai echad ushmo echad. The Lord shall be king over all the earth. In that day, there will be one Lord with one name. There is a mountain in the prophet that is mentioned. It's in Jerusalem. It's mentioned as being part of the vision of the latter days. That, of course, is where Menachem Begin chose to be buried. It was, in many respects, as we know now, a biblical life. On Israel's 10th anniversary, he gave a speech, which is famous because some of the words from it now adorn the entrance to the Menachem Begin Heritage Center, where he said at the end of the long speech, Lo bizchut ha-koach shavnu le'eretz avotenu, shavnu elea b'koach hazchut. It's a kind of a play on words, which is very hard to translate into English, but more or less, we did not come back to the land of our ancestors by the virtue of strength, but by the strength of virtue, so to speak, or by the strength of the fact that it belonged to us. As I mentioned, this was the continuation, as far as he was concerned, of the story of the Bible. This was the continuation of the story of what he called those Lochamim Ivriim, not the Israeli fighters, but the Hebrew fighters. That was the language that he used at the Altalena. It's the language that he used all the time. It was the story of the Jewish people returning to the land from which they had been twice exiled, but the land that they had never, ever left willingly. I'll end with this. The videos of the funeral, which, as I said, are hard to come by, show a very simple funeral. The elderly men really struggling to carry his stretcher up the hill. Then, of course, he's placed in the grave, and there's El Malei Rachamim, and Benny says Kaddish, all the things that you would expect to see. And all the people are around there. Mary Dora is there, and Rabin is there, and so on and so forth. And then the funeral's supposed to be over. But it's entirely anticlimactic because there was no real formality. It was a traditional Jewish, very informal funeral, and people just didn't know how to leave. And something extraordinary happened. They began to sing the Beitar anthem. with which I'll conclude this lecture. Tagar al kol ma'atzar u'meitzar im ta'alo tered belard ha'mered sa'esh lehatzit en davar ki sheket hu refesh hafker dam vanefesh leman ha'hod hanistar lamut olichposhet ahar yodefet masada beitar. Fortitude in the face of every obstacle, in times of ascent and of setbacks, a fire may still be lit with the flame of revolt. For silence is dirt. Sacrifice blood and spirit for the hidden glory. To conquer, or to die or conquer the mountain, Yodfat Masada Beitar. Yehi Zichro Baruch, may his memory be a blessing and an inspiration to us all.